gangster ass niggas don't talk much. All you hear is the black from the gun blast. And real gangster ass niggas don't run for shit. It's real gangster ass niggas can't run fast. Now when you in the free world talking shit, you the shit. Hit the pin and let a motherfucker shank you. But niggas like myself kick back and keep game. Cause damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
I'm John.
And I'm Ash.
And we have a special guest with us this week. Joining us at least for the first few segments of our pod. Welcome, Jaleesa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Anytime. Jaleesa has been a very, very significant supporter of ours. And also happens to host a few, what we call spoiler lounges in the Orphan Black Clone Club After Hour, which Ash has referenced a few times on this pod. So if you're on Facebook, go check it out. Please like, comment, share, subscribe, especially comment. We got a couple of comments. We really appreciate it last week. Helps us know what you guys are looking for. So we're going to start out with How to Get Away with Murder. And the episode was titled, I Want You to Die. Ash, let's start with you. What'd you think?
I just want to hold Bonnie. I just do. I really did enjoy this episode, though. This case of the week was blah. No one really cares. But I love how, you know, the dynamic between the groups, like, this week it was Annalise and Laurel, and eventually, you know, Annalise and Bonnie. But I love how, you know, each episode it's, you know,
who is Annalise up. Tormenting most recently?
it's giving everyone, you know, motive and, you know, ambition to, like, who, like, it leaves you wondering, like, who really done, I mean, granted, we know who killed, you know, the DA this episode, but I'm loving the way it's playing out.
Jaleesa, what do you think?
I liked it. I also just want to hug Bonnie. She, I really didn't like her in the first season very much.
Why?
I don't know. She just didn't do anything for me. She always just kind of seems like just
one of those,
just there and like just easy, you know, easy to throw away, but
poor Bonnie. I actually want to hug her now.
Yeah, it's like I even feel bad for thinking, oh, I would have thrown you away last year, but
well, last week I called her innocent. I have to take that back now. I said even though she's like a murderer, she still seems innocent. Not really anymore. I also said she was my favorite character on the show, which is still true, but she's all of a sudden like a rage monster, which I like for her, because it's almost like she can completely flip her humanity switch like a Vampire Diaries vampire or something, and it makes sense for her to me. Does it make sense for you guys that Bonnie has become like a mass murderer?
I don't know about mass murderer.
Okay, well, she's killed at least two people.
Yeah, well,
I mean, with her history and everything, it makes sense to me. I mean, and then, you know, the way that she has to deal with being treated by Annalise, I'd be wanting to kill some people also.
Yeah, like, I'm sorry. It was like, damn, it, like, when Bonnie was just, like, getting into her and just saying all that shit to Annalise, I was like, thank you. You're standing up for yourself. You're sick of her shit. It was like...
But was this the time, like, of all the things Annalise has done to Bonnie, was, like, keeping her out of prison really, like, the time that you wanted her to make her stand? I don't...
Yeah, but it's what she did. It was, like, to Bonnie, she probably would have rather, you know, this is something that's, you know, fucked her up, like, for real, like, since she was a child. And that's something she doesn't want, like, people to know. You know, because it still fucks with her head. So she probably would have rather gone to jail than, you know,
I understand that's what the character says, but still, as like an objective third party, out of all the things Annalise has done to Bonnie, this is one where you could say, I don't know, maybe it was for her own good. Maybe it's for the best.
I understood why Annalise did it, Well, one thing Annalise could have did was at least tell Bonnie, like, yo, I did
exactly.
this. You know, she shouldn't have figured it out from, you know, her boyfriend, or ex-boyfriend now, that, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, Annalise, she figured out that, you know, Annalise told her boyfriend that she was indeed raped by her father.
Well, how about Asher not just be an idiot and not admit it?
Bonnie's not stupid, you know.
So yeah, but Asher is. There lies the problem.
Yeah. He's not stupid. He just
lacks common sense.
Idiot. He's not stupid. He's just stupid.
Yeah.
So
I don't think the writers really know what they want to do with Asher yet. So they're just, I mean, they're playing with him a lot. I mean, you know, one week he's acting one way, and you know, he's just stupid and goofy. And then sometimes they have him a little serious, and it's. Sometimes it just comes off as weird to me, so I don't know if they know what they're wanting to do with him yet.
Yeah, Ash and I have talked about him as just like a pure comic relief character before, which I'm not crazy about. I'm sort of glad they're involving him more in, I don't know, in the shit this year, more in the, like, piled on A-plot and not just in, like, to be random, like, really randomized, you know, humorous breaks, you know, comedic relief during the
yeah.
B plot. But we need to talk about, there was a lot of people online, anyway, from what I saw on my feed, that thought the Famke Annalise scene contained an admission that Wes is indeed Annalise Keating's son. I don't buy that. Do you guys buy that?
I think they want us to think that,
yeah.
But you know, all of my knowledge of watching TV for so many years is telling me they're just trying to fake us out.
Yeah, they want us to believe, think one way, so they're gonna like hit us with a Mack truck with some other revelation that we didn't even think of.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with both of you guys, especially because of what happened last week, where we found out that whoever Wes identifies as his mother, which for all we know we would think is his mother, somehow sacrificed to get him into this country. So in order to make the Annalise Keating is Wes's mother storyline work, the writers would somehow have to figure out why she adopted a baby son into a part of the world where he was like going to be a refugee if he did get into the
America. Yeah, right. Yeah, that wouldn't make sense.
I don't know. I feel like early in her career, she had this like just big case that somehow involved him, and she saved him, or I don't know. There's something like that going on.
It very well could be.
There was a case involving his mother while they was in the country, and so she knows who that kid is. Maybe it could be that.
Yeah, very well. I mean, clearly she knew. She's probably been keeping track of him a while. It might be the reason Waitlist actually got into the university, but I don't know. I don't think it's because it's his mother, and you guys don't think you do either. Let me ask, switching gears back to Bonnie for a minute, what we didn't discuss, and sort of a sensitive topic, so I'm going to try to tread gently. Is Bonnie's framing of the Asher situation valid? And what I mean is, I know she has her own personal biases, and we can talk about those. But is there any way that you can reasonably hold Asher responsible for what other people did at a party he hosted one time?
It's not... did you go ahead, Jennifer?
I don't... I think just because her past, it kind of allows her to be more ridiculous and show more emotion and, you know, just have more of an emotional connection to what happened. It's like she... You know, like what Annalise said is that, you know, she needs to come to terms with what happened, and she clearly hasn't yet, and I think she's just kind of projecting her feelings and what happened to her onto him because he was kind of like a half-bad guy in the situation that he was in.
I agree, especially because it was almost disturbing to watch how much she internalized that victim and projected it back onto Asher. Like, it was almost as if she was, you know, like, seeing the person who molested her when she looked at him, which is, you know, a disturbing thing, seeing how it happened decades ago, we're led to believe.
Yeah, Lock off is the What happened to her, you know, changed her perspective in a sense, you know, what situations like that can happen. I don't think it was necessary. Well, she did reject herself into the situation, but it also showed that the fact that he didn't do anything or say anything afterwards, and he just allowed this to be, you know, pushed under the rug and then go on with his life. I think that's what also bothered her. Like, as this.
Yeah, but she just murdered somebody and then went on with her life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Just a little hypocritical there.
Leave money alone, okay?
I just couldn't believe this was a PSA episode. At the end, there was a PSA, and I was just like, I don't know if this was the time for that.
Yeah.
I guess we have to talk about, let's go to Jaleesa first. Is Oliver dead?
I think it's another one of those things, they want us to think he's going to be dead. They're kind of trying to fake us out. I don't think he's going to be dead at the beginning of the episode. He may end up getting killed, but I think, no, he's not dead.
Yeah, I don't think he's dead. And if he is going to die, he's not dead yet. First of all, Oliver's hard-headed. He should have stayed the fuck away from Keating's house like Connor warned him. But, like, I was like, boy, run the fuck away, just leave, just don't ever step foot in that fucking death trap. But, yeah, I don't think he's dead yet. If he's gonna die, he's not dead yet.
But Annalise is so nice. I'm gonna tell why both of you guys are right that he's not dead yet, because if a character like Oliver, who is a sympathetic character to the audience, and a show with very few sympathetic characters, if they are going to kill him off, every logical, like, series-based process in my mind says you show his death, like, so that the audience, you know, processes it and feels it. You don't, like, do it off-camera. So, yeah, he's not dead yet.
Or the killer could record it, and then we'll actually see the death.
I don't know. I'm not. That sounds a lot like what happened on Stalker. Wasn't that like the plot line? One more thing we should get to is why I have my own theory. But either of you guys really have? Did you draw any conclusions about why Annalise was so hard on Laurel and why she was quite frankly terrible to Laurel this week? Like, all of a sudden, she's never really had beef with Laurel before.
Well, she explained it in the episode to Laurel. She said that Laurel...
Whoa, 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 stop. She told Laurel, but do you actually believe anything Annalise says to somebody?
Well, then she said that, you know, the biggest compliment she could give someone is hearing them. She doesn't have to watch over them. She doesn't have to constantly be on top of them to do their job and do it correctly. So, you know... She told, you know, I mean...
And that's a nice way to motivate somebody you plan on ignoring.
Makes you want to try harder.
I was thinking maybe she was projecting her own, like, feelings about... She was sort of hating herself for how she allowed Nate and other men to, like, control her life lately. And so she was, like, taking that out on Laurel when she saw Laurel with another man. She knew. I don't know.
I think it's also that at this point, you know, Laurel is the, out of, you know, her students so far, Laurel is the one who's not the fuck up. I know I'm not the biggest fan of Laurel, but I will agree that Laurel is the one with the, you know, the most solid head on her fucking shoulders, you know, out of the crew. So, yeah, like, keep your head in the game, you know, don't let this man, you know, fuck with your head, you know, just... I need you on this.
So, back to Jaleesa. Was this just an excuse to have some actual scenes between Annalise and Laurel? Like, is that the only reason? Like, I'm looking structurally, from a writer's standpoint, why have this if it's just as straightforward as Annalise tells us?
I don't know. I don't really like Laurel either. Her character.
Nobody likes Laurel.
But in this episode, I mean, she she's proved herself. I mean, and like Ash said, she's not, you know, out of all of them, she's not a fuck up. So, I mean, there's so many, like, main characters that it's hard for them to kind of get them all to interact and have them all on a personal level. So this is kind of their way of getting Annalise and Laurel on a personal, you know, type thing of saying, hey, you know, I don't go around you too much and I don't talk to you too much because I feel like I don't have to. So that could have been, like, the writer's way of, you know, kind of not having to have them together a lot.
Yeah, I guess explain why, you know, out of all the characters, why isn't there haven't been, you know, much interaction with Annalise and Laurel. Because, you know, usually her focus is on Wes. Lately it's been on Asher. We got Connor, you know, it's the cat and Michaela, you know, it's been the characters that have been fucking up, but I don't think there's ever been a 1-on-1 with Annalise and Laurel. So this episode explained why.
Okay, and explain why to Laurel. I'm still going to take the standpoint that when Annalise addresses someone directly, we can assume she is manipulating him. Like, there's no reason to believe anything she says. Like, even when she's talking to Fomke, I'm not sure I believe that she actually cares about her. Like, she gets shit from her. I don't believe that she appreciates Oliver. She gets shit from Oliver.
Yeah, exactly. Like, run!
Poor Oliver. I think he's like the one character everybody does like, and now he's the kidnap. Which I guess works. I mean, if you're going to have somebody as the victim. Lisa, what was your favorite scene from I Want You to Die?
Probably that last scene with Bonnie and Annalise when Bonnie just goes after her and tells her that, you know, that she can't love anybody and that she wished it was her and not Sam. I really liked Bonnie in that scene. And she just told Annalise to fuck off, and I loved it.
I would like to point out that was the third character this year that has told Annalise that she doesn't know how to love people. Ash.
I have to go with the same scene. You know, the way Bonnie just, you know, released all of, you know, frustrations, you know, with her life, but also, you know, towards Annalise, you know, all the shit that's been piled upon her that Annalise has given her, you know, she finally just released the shit. She's had enough at this point. And she's tired, you know, feeling like some pawn to Annalise, you know, for someone who's supposed to supposedly care about her. And because the thing about Annalise, I think she does care. I think she just she tries to fix things, but she also destroys at the same time. So
I'm going
to
say that's true, and you're right. I just still think this is a bad example of that, because if I was Bonnie, I don't care what secret she told my girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, I would be thankful she kept my ass out of prison. I don't care. There's nothing, no matter how shady, that one person could find out that would be worth not going to prison.
She should at least told Bonnie that she did it, though, and not try to throw her a bone that she didn't even deserve.
My favorite scenes on the show are still the ones where you can feel they happen from time to time, where you can feel the weight of the words. And that you have the knowledge that you don't really know the context. And we knew all the context for the AK Bonnie scene, so not that one. But I'm going to go with the Annalise Fomke scene in the bar where they talk about Wes. Because there is a lot of, like, knowing and understanding and, like, clearly a history in the way they look at each other and speak to each other that we're still trying to figure out and work our way around. And I find that really fascinating, the way the show works with that. So we'll be back next week. Thank you, Jaleesa. Next up, we're going to do AHS and Scream Queens is back. Beware of Young Girls. Scream Queens is back this week. How did you feel about this episode, Ash?
I guess I enjoyed it. There was a lot of characters missing in this episode, like Denise and...
That's two episodes in a row without Denise. Three weeks without Denise Hempfield. Are you having withdrawals?
Yeah, what's that about? But I found it interesting, you know, it felt like it was resetting a lot of things. Like, you have the Chanels, you know, back together, you know, as one, and you have that more story on Dean Munch and stuff like that. So I feel like the story's kind of going forward, but
yeah,
I feel like it was also reshifting some things.
Jaleesa, I feel like we buried the lead. Her name is Randy, and she is a non-human helper companion. How do you feel about Chad's secret love affair?
I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was, it was over the top. It was funny. I didn't expect that.
No, that's not exactly what I saw coming either.
He's not intolerant, guys. He's got to drink the goat's milk. He can't, if that's what he's got to do to get his milk.
Okay, but did he really have to milk the goat before he could screw Chanel? Like, was that necessary?
And strong bone and thief.
I just want to tell you guys right now, I really hope Chanel 1 gives my funeral speech. So if I die, please contact Emma Roberts with my last wishes. I want it in character, and I don't want any preachers. I just want Emma Roberts addressing the people on my behalf.
Okay,
good. Glad we got that. So, are we supposed to want the blonde pledge and the guy who should keep pretending to be Matthew McConaughey to be together? Is that something we're supposed to want?
Let alone together.
Yeah.
I mean, are they really that relevant?
Not to me.
No.
What episode are we on and I don't know their names?
Grace? I don't know. I can never remember the guy's name. But yeah, the girl's name is Grace.
And...
The guy's name in real life is Diego Boneta. I remember that for some reason, but I don't know his name on the show.
I refer to him as Matthew, so I don't know his real name.
So we haven't spoken to you about Scream Queens. I knew you watched it. Are you a big fan of the show? Like, how do you feel about the show through, like, what, 6 or 7 episodes?
I wouldn't call myself a big fan. I mean, I love the music that goes into it. I mean, Ryan Murphy, if anything, he's a musical genius. I hated Glee, but he is a musical genius.
Wait. If you hated Glee, what are you basing his musical geniusness on?
I mean, it's odd. I hated Glee. I watched a few seasons of it. I wanted to tear my eyes out. It was horrible.
He did give us Naya Rivera. It can't be that bad.
But, I like it. I don't love it, I don't think. I think I could eventually start to love it, but I would have to make that declaration at the finale, because
right.
I wanted to, right now it doesn't seem like, there's a plot, but I don't know if I could pinpoint the main plot and where it's going at some time.
Let me throw a theory I have about the show at you, and then you tell me what you think about what I just said. The show is better when it is focused on the Chanels and Kappa, even without Denise Entfield, because at its core, it's a satire of the horror genre in Greek life. And as good as Niecy Nash is, or Jamie Lee Curtis at times, when it focuses on them or other characters, it's just showing like random humorous people who are somehow attached to the Greek house that is supposed to be being satirized in the first place. When Chanel is the focus, not only can Ryan Murphy poke fun at Chanel and like all her friends, Chanel can do her like I'm so blunt and mean it's hilarious shtick on the side, and there's like two levels of humor to it that otherwise doesn't come through. Agree, disagree?
Yeah, I agree.
I definitely.
Okay, well then, I was trying to open us up for some debate, but that's cool. Do you guys feel confident regarding anything about the show's mystery? Like, do you feel like you're confident about who the Red Devils are at all? Go ahead, Ash.
Well, I'm saying it's more than one. Hell, it could be more than two.
Yeah.
So, anything can go at this point. So, Who the fuck knows? It could be actually, you know, it'd be crazy if it actually is Zayday is fucking...
I wouldn't be surprised at this point. And like, it, just for Denise Hempfield to be like, I told
like,
you
I
so.
I knew it. Like, I fucking knew it.
Just for that scene, it might be worth it. Jaleesa, yeah. Do you have a good idea or at all?
Well, I mean, I think when they do reveal it, it's gonna be. I mean, it's gonna be over the top. It's probably gonna be some character that was in like season or you know in episode 2 for like 5 seconds.
Well, Boone is definitely involved. I feel confident that Boone is. Yeah, if he's coming back next week, like he's got. He's not just gone away. He's somehow involved. I was a little sad that that Chanel 2 was definitely murdered when she was typing on Twitter.
I'm not sad to see her gone, that's for sure.
That's still one of my like favorite scenes. Cause that shit was so stupid, but it was so damn funny.
Oh wait, guys, can we talk about the black fur earmuffs that Chanel 3 wore to the funeral? Those were perfect, and she is perfect.
They were. Using damn earmuffs.
Jaleesa and I actually talked about this on Facebook the other day. Ash, how do you feel about Billy Lord's performance this year as Chanel 3? Because we were both like praising it, saying how good we thought she had been.
I have to agree. You know, I wasn't too sure about Chanel number 3 at first. In fact, besides Chanel number 1, I wasn't too sure about, you know, any of them. They all kind of seemed like a one-note character, but I have to say, she's probably becoming one of my favorite characters of the series so far.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. And what it's a one performance. It's like a performance that wins you over. It doesn't blow you out of the water at first.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's so neat about it are like the little things she does, like tilting her head to the side a lot. And she like when she gets all stressed out, she starts tugging on her earmuffs. I don't know. I really like the way Carrie Fisher's daughter, Billy Lord, does that character. We should probably go ahead and go to AHS so we have some time to talk about it. Do either of you guys have a specific favorite scene from Beware of Young Girls? Go ahead, Jaleesa. Sorry, it doesn't matter.
I don't know if there was, you know, something that, I mean, that I just straight out had a favorite. I mean, I thought probably the funeral just because it was hilarious and I just loved it. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that was great. I liked it. You know, it was hilarious. I wasn't expecting it, so.
I agree. I mean, black earmuffs, black fur earmuffs, and the funeral speech by Emma Roberts. So, no contest. Ash.
Well, I guess I'll be different. I have to say Chad and the goat. That shit was funny. Like you think it was like you're so full of shit, but then again, Chad wouldn't really have a reason to lie because he doesn't really lie. He's a very honest person. So like the fact that he has a goat in his room, that like why can't he just buy the milk or something?
I have to know if he's a human companion helper or whatever. How is it possible that his girlfriend's never heard about it before now?
Exactly. Well, it was so ridiculous, but it was funny as shit.
Okay.
The fact that he had to drop specs to try to, you know, get some milk out of the goat.
You're definitely right with that. Okay, so room service was AHS Hotel this week, and it's probably the best episode so far. It was definitely the most interesting, and it was almost like two separate episodes, and I have very different feelings about those two episodes.
Yeah.
Jaleesa, the first reason I asked you to come on with us is because you are such a big fan of American Horror Story and might have more to say about it than either of us. So I'm just going to let you start with how you felt about room service.
Well, I agree with it kind of felt like two separate episodes. To me, the beginning was a shit fest. It was horrible. I hated it. The whole little baby vamp army thing. That's just... I don't know where they could go with that. They brought it in. There was all these little mini vampires.
You could become the strain.
They did not touch upon it again. After that, it was like a complete turn, and then it was just straight amazing. The Liz Taylor backstory, Lady Gaga, you know, the Countess and her, the quotes that she had, I mean, the beginning, I hated it. The second half of the episode, I thought it was the greatest thing of the season so far.
I agree with that, and I will say why I agree with that is that, look, we knew Dennis O'Hare's character, Liz Taylor, was interesting, and she had been around in the back of scenes for a while, and I don't know, it felt well-earned after spending several episodes with her in the shadows. This is how good filmmakers like Matthew Weiner in Mad Men or Vince Gilligan in Better Call Saul or... Breaking Bad. Like, this is how they expand their world. They take a minor character and then they show their backstory, or they show like a day in the life of this little minor character. What they don't do is be like, here's somebody whose name you don't know. Let's just follow them around for 40 minutes while they go on a killing spree. So I agree with you, and especially because it's not so much as where we go from here, it's where we came from. And we as an audience were interested in Liz Taylor in the way we definitely weren't about Measles Boy. Ash, do you agree with us? Did you love the Vamp Kids? What do you think?
Hello? I can't even hear right now. Hello?
Hey, Ash, are you with us?
Yeah.
Okay, I was saying, did you agree with what we were saying in principle, or did you like the Vampire
You're
Kids?
You're breaking up. I really can't. I literally can't.
All right, hold on. Sorry about that, guys. A little technical difficulty. Ash is back with us now. Ash, how did you feel about the episode? Do you agree with us that the Vampire Kids were, you know, kind of random and shitty?
Yeah, absolutely. That shit was fucking confusing, fucking stupid. And I have no idea where the hell they're going with that shit. The thing that bothered me was, you know, the doctor. Like, why would she fucking inject this kid with her blood?
I don't know.
And, like, he's like, you just can't just start turning vampires all willy-nilly and expect no consequences.
And how did the kid instantly realize he was a vampire? Wake up and be like, what is going on? Not just kill.
And if I knew how to change people like that.
Yeah, just instinctively. How'd you feel about Liz Taylor? Did you love it as much as we did?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely loved it. It's probably one of the best stories of the season so far. Like, that right there. Because Liz Taylor, you know, the character was, you know, very, you know, in the shadows, in the background, but it was always around, you know, giving some form of life advice to people. It was, you know, the bartender, in a sense.
Yeah.
Well, literally. So, you know, sitting around making drinks and giving out advice, but now it's, here she is telling her own story.
Right.
And it was very beautifully done, and it gave the Countess, you know, more insight into her.
Well, it was like the first seemingly altruistic thing we've ever seen the Countess do. I don't know if it was altruistic. We might get more on that later. But for now, it seems like she had no ulterior motive other than to be nice to this trans woman.
Yeah, I agree. It showed a possible humanity that she does indeed have with her.
Maybe. I mean, unless she just realized she could get, like, a bartender for life. Who could never leave that So, I thought going into this episode, one of the biggest problems is that we didn't really have any relatable characters or sympathetic characters. We leave it not only with Liz Taylor having more of a story so we can care about her, but I think, I thought Kathy Bates was brilliant in this episode. I thought her performance and, like, emergence as a vengeance monster with a vendetta against entitled youth was awesome. It was very, very... Not only was it cool, it was well done. And I thought this was the most impressive performance on AHS this year was Kathy Bates in this episode.
Absolutely. I agree.
From the shaking when she was, like, transforming to especially watching her with Jessica Liu, who I always liked on an MTV show called Awkward, like watching her with Jessica Liu, and as like she just could not control herself and had to kill this bitch.
Oh man, they had to die.
Well, they at least they had Pate first.
Catflip.
Jaleesa, what do you? I sort of think that the reason this episode, even though it was really good, especially the later stages were really good. The reason it feels fractured, and the reason we had to incorporate the horror story about children not getting vaccinated and then going on killing sprees, to be topical, was that Ryan Murphy, I believe, cannot edit himself. He has to have two shows, and one of his shows has to go on for an hour and a half every week. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't know. I sometimes think that FX kind of gives him too much liberty for the show. And, you know, they give him the hour and a half episodes. And, you know, they did it this with Sons of Anarchy, too. You know, they get this niche show, and then they just give them this freedom. And then they just kind of go crazy with it. And sometimes it just doesn't make sense. And that's been kind of my problem with the last few seasons of American Horror Story is that it's not kind of focusing on one thing. You know, there's not like one big plot. There's like four or five plots that are just, you know, they're not big, they're just kind of there, and it's hard to focus in on it.
Yeah, it needs one main plot, and then it can have side plots as well, but it needs a main plot, and I don't know what the main plot of this season is. I really don't.
I mean, I think they're going to somehow try to tie it together with what you were saying, Ash, last week about Jon Snow being the Ten Commandments killer. I don't necessarily like how we were getting there, but I think it's clear that you were right and that we are getting there. I don't know about FX though. Like FX does, I think it's a really good thing that they tend to give their creators a lot of liberties. They did the same with Stephen Falk and You're the Worst, a comedy I love a lot. They did the same with Fargo, a show we discussed on here, and I think Noah Hawley does it really well. I just think some people, when they're giving all this creative liberty, as Jaleesa suggested, can still edit themselves and figure out how to tell concise stories. Fargo is a very concise story, and some people like Ryan Murphy just fucking go all over the place. And sometimes it's brilliant, and sometimes it's horrific and not the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Jaleesa, do you also agree with with Ash? And now I'm piling on. Jon Snow's going to be the Ten Commandments murderer.
Oh, of course. I've thought that for many episodes now. But
Really?
I think, you know, it may be also one of those things that's so obvious that, you know, if the Ten Commandments killer thing is what we think is going to be like this big part of the season and what it's going to, I think maybe because it's so obvious, it might take a different turn and it's going to surprise us somehow. Or maybe I just have a lot of hope for this season.
I thought for the first few episodes, I thought Sally was going to be the Ten Commandments killer, but I think it's pretty clear that's not right. Yeah. Did you have a favorite scene, Jaleesa? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, you're good. Favorite scene? I mean, how could you not pick the Liz Taylor backstory, that stuff? I mean, I love that. I think that was, you know, the thing that, you know, most people could connect the most with. I mean, that's gotta be it. I mean, I hated everything from the first half of the episode.
Ash,
I'd rather.
I'm sorry. I keep cutting you off. I think you're through talking and you're not. My bad.
No, you're good. I was just
Yeah, I have to agree. The Liz Taylor backstory was very beautifully done. It had me all in my feelings, and I was like, don't do that. Especially since I was all pissed off about this whole vamp army thing. And it was like, oh, I was so mad. Me and Jaleesa was in the spoiler lounge, just like, what the fuck is this? And then you hit us with the Liz Taylor story. It's like, okay, you brought us back in. Okay, thank you. And it was very beautifully done with the time period and everything. I loved it.
I'm surprised by you guys. I love the Liz Taylor stuff too. I thought the best scene was the scene where Kathy Bates finally became free to be the killer she was always meant to be. Where she just could not control herself anymore and had to kill those fucking kids.
I think I hated those stupid hipster kids so much that I couldn't call it a favorite scene because of how much I hated
But
them.
they died
Yeah,
in
they were.
it. That's what's so like. That's why you love it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's.
It's still a little over the top, though, the kids. But
yeah, probably. But that's not, they weren't the point. Like, the point was Kathy Bates becoming, like, not dependent on anybody and, like, doing whatever the fuck she wants to do.
Yeah, but I think that was another scene where Ryan Murphy took liberties with the fact that the guy was this big Glee star, and so he had to write him this big part, and, you know, he made it, you know, he centered him around, like, so many minutes of this episode, and then he just killed him off in this grand way. I think that kind of overshadowed Kathy's, you know, Kathy's whole transformation and all that for me, is because he gave so much spotlight to this non-essential character because he's a Glee actor.
Maybe so. I was just focused in on, like, Kathy's face and, like, her little trembling and her little hand gestures as she was in the room. Like, I don't know. I loved it. Jaleesa, thank you very much for joining us this week. We appreciate it. Hopefully we can have her back in the future.
Yep.
All right, Jaleesa, all right. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you. So it's nothing that you can say to me. I'm proud to go where I grew up, and it's the newest slavery. People see you trying hard, like, why you wanna play with me? I bring them heaters out, somebody better pray for me. Cause all I know is this money, I gotta have it. These suicidal thoughts getting bad, I'm getting madder. They say the good die young. I put the pedal to the metal, hit the gas, then I'm gone. Now. So this is a very musical episode of Empire, Ash. I let us in with Boom 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 Boom. Newly released. The episode's called A High Hope for a Low Heaven. What'd you think of it?
When I first watched it, I wasn't necessarily really into it because I didn't understand exactly what was going on. I thought that it was possibly too much. But then when the more I thought about it, the more I understood.
I just want to start out by saying, I'm going to be hard on Empire this week because I know it can be better. This isn't a situation where I think the show is broken or that it's a bad show or it's shitty. I just think it misfired. But I like that it at least took a chance by giving Brashear Gray, the guy who plays Hakeem, a lot more responsibility. That said, I think the biggest reason this episode fell flat for me is because Brashear Gray doesn't have the chops to pull off what they were trying to put on his plate.
Well?
Yeah, Ash. He does not have the chops to pull off what they put on his plate. All the shaky cams and the super close-ups in the world aren't going to change that. He's a lot better as, like, an impetuous child or comic relief, but as a PTSD and possible concussion victim, I just did not buy that. I just didn't buy the performance, especially compared to a lot more subtle performance like we saw from Jesse Plemons in Fargo a couple of weeks ago. Like, I didn't think the soapy elements of the show and, like, the Hakeem is a trauma victim shit worked together, and I especially didn't think Brashear Gray played it well enough to work together.
I guess I can somewhat agree, but I think that, and I don't know if they actually, I think they may have been hinting at it. I'm thinking that it was more than just, you know, I think there's more that happened that he's not speaking about, that what happened when he was snatched. I think it's possible that he was possibly sexually assaulted, which would explain a lot of Hakeem's behavior for the rest of the episode.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, I don't doubt that at all. My issue isn't with plot, it's just with presentation and execution. But that being said, Hakeem doesn't have any damn sense. I mean, you don't get kidnapped and start off by going, you know who I am? Yeah, they know who you are. That's why they kidnapped you. The fuck's
yeah,
all...
that was it. Just the fuck down.
I mean, I just don't like the character. He's seen a lot of the world, but he doesn't get any of it. And I sort of agree with Lucius. Like, he's a boy, and it's not just this episode. It's all of Empire. He is a boy trying to play it being a man. And to quote Lucius, he wallows in bitch-assness. That is what, I mean, Hakeem has always done. He's just a spoiled child. And I have a hard time seeing him be more. Because when he tries to be an adult, he doesn't have an identity outside of his parents.
Well, I think this episode
Hey, your episode.
this episode showed that I think it was showing how both Lucius and Cookie were both not necessarily, even though they were worried about their son, they was like, okay, now get through it, and because we both need something from you, we both want something from you, so you need to just get over it and get through it. Which his brothers took a different approach and actually try to, you know, focus on Hakeem and not what they needed from him.
I mean, fair enough, but I just think it speaks to Hakeem's immaturity that he didn't realize that, like, or hasn't accepted the fact that as, like, a star musician, like, of course his producers are going to want him to make music. It doesn't matter if they're your parents or not. They've always been your producers. I mean by, like, he's seen a lot of the world, but he just doesn't get it. Like, he just doesn't.
I also feel like they don't put a lot of, they was treating him more as a musician more instead of, you know, treating him as, you know,
a son.
Their son first.
And they've always, at least Lucius especially has done that with Jamal and Andre too. It's not like he's doing it just to Hakeem. I mean, that's the Lucius Lyon M.O. Which made, one thing I did like a lot was Lucius's intervention with Little Rock, with Breezy. I mean, dramatically, it seemed true to the character that he is replacing his son with the girl he claims to and probably does identify with. And I also think she's probably the best rapper on the cast. Like, so in an episode flooded with music, most of which I didn't care for, like, I at least thought she was pretty good, better than Hakeem.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So, why was Lucius not more upset, though, about Andre turning Gutter Life into a Christian label? We already know how he feels about Christianity. Like, shouldn't he be irate?
I think it's more, I think Andre was saying, like, he didn't force it upon,
Oh, God, what was that guy's name? I could do without him. Papa G.
Yeah, there you go. he said it wasn't forced upon him, and that it was indeed a business decision. And not
that's what he said, but he did. It wasn't a business decision. He said, we're not going to make decisions based on making money. We're going to base them on the character of a man. Okay, that's cool if you're going to be in a church, not so much if you're going to run a record label.
That's true.
I don't know. How did you feel about the scene with Papa G and Becky?
It was definitely random.
It was.
There was no build-up to it. It was just, like, there. It was like, am I supposed to care that Becky's getting laid or something?
I kind of felt good that... my negative comments, and I have more, but this episode, if did nothing else, it let Becky play a little. It showed a large woman being sexual on TV, which we don't see a lot.
Yeah.
And it also, I like her relationship with Jamal a lot. Like, it's just really playful and one of the more subtle things on the show.
Yeah, it's just that I think I would have liked it more if it was some sort of build up to it, or at least a little hint, like. In a past episode, so it was just like, bam.
I don't know.
Like,
I think if you're going to put so Precious random. Like half naked on the TV, you don't build up to that.
No,
you just do it.
It had nothing to do with that. It was just like, I wish there was some build up to it. It was like, I don't care about Papa G or whatever his name is. So I was like,
I was just trying to figure out who he was. Like, if he, what
right?
he
I was confused. I
honestly thought we were about to get like a rape scene or something because he was like,
oh,
he was on top of her and he was like, you don't need to go to work. And I was like, wait, what is
that? Yeah, I was like, dude, she got to go to work. And you know who her boss is, so like, let her go. Don't be creepy about it.
And don't snitch. She, for the love of God. I want to say I was wrong and you were right. This show, I don't know that I was wrong at the time, I have become wrong. Because this is not more of a family drama. This is more of a soap opera. And I thought this episode was as soapy as it got, man. Like, there was suspense from out of nowhere. And it brought the family together. But then it ripped the family back apart all within 30 minutes. And now we can feel sympathy for these unlikable characters who were getting too dark.
Yeah.
What do you think about the Anika hookup?
felt really bad for her. I do feel bad for the character Anika, because she's this character, like, when she was walking down the sidewalk and just, like, crying on her, like, pretty much crying on her phone and saying, talk to her mother, saying she doesn't have anyone. Like, this was a woman who had, you know, pretty much everything. You know, she was getting married to, you know, Lucius. You know, she was head of, you know, PR and stuff like that. And now she's been broken down and just kicked to the curb by everybody. Like, Hakeem don't even really speak to her. He just happened to show up and, like, slept with her and then dipped out. And when she went to check on him, he pretty much like, oh, I'm good, and closed the door in her face pretty much. So it was kind of... I feel bad for her.
God, I hope they are leading something with this. Because, I mean, it's hard to judge a storyline mid-season, a character arc especially, but... I hate what has happened to her, and if they don't do anything with this, like, shame on Empire. Because they've taken what was, like, a strong female character and a rival for Cookie and made her into, like, this little weak whipping girl. And I don't really see the purpose right now. And I don't understand. I don't buy it either in the world of the show. She was, like, a high-powered, like, you know, producer. And was apparently really good at it, from what we're told. And now she can't get a job and doesn't have any friends. Like, what, because Lucius broke up with you? What? I mean, I get that Lucius is, like, you know, king of the rap game. But he's not going to keep you. He doesn't hold sway over everybody in the world. Like, you can get a job and a new friend. Yeah. It's okay.
I guess that's a self-esteem issue with her right now. I think that's what the issue is with her. Self-esteem.
I'm just gonna, see, do you have a favorite episode or anything before favorite episode that I've skipped over? You think we need to get to?
No, not really. It's just that, you know, like I said before, it was this episode. I understood it, but I thought it was not doing it right. But I think this is, this episode is a setup to more to come. I think that's what it is.
I think you're probably right about that.
Yeah, because like I said, I think something happened with Hakeem while he was taken. While he was taken, more than just an ass whooping. I think, you know, something happened, which is why he ran over to Anika so fast to sleep with her.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the way he's just been behaving, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think, and, you know, I mean, that also helps explain why he felt the need to pull a gun on a bunch of, you know, criminals, thugs. But, I don't know. The one thing I didn't say that I would like to, I've sort of forgot about, I'm really interested in what they're doing with Andre and religion. Like, are we meant to understand that because he's mentally ill, he is more likely to fall victim to religion? Like, it's some kind of prank or scam? That's almost like the message I feel like we're getting from the show right now, and it's really interesting that the most popular show on television, like, one spiritual character is also, like, a, you know, complete, you know, I mean, he's completely mentally fractured. He's not stable.
I think it's maybe, I guess, you know, in Andre's mind, that religion is all he'll probably mostly need to heal himself, which is what a lot of people believe, especially when it comes to mental illness and stuff like that. You know, they just need, you know, some spiritual guidance to help them heal with that.
Yeah. To your point earlier, I think that might be something that, you know, I have some problems with this episode. I think it's part of watching it weekly, and it's one of the, like, weird things about television in our time, is that if you binge watch a show, it's a different experience than watching it week to week.
Yeah.
And, you know, this episode I didn't like because, you know, I left it here. I might like where these storylines go, and if somebody binges it later, they may never stop to think, wow, that was sort of an empty episode. Like, but as a viewer watching it week to week, it sort of left a bad taste in my mouth. My favorite scene, though, was the one I mentioned earlier with Chris Rock and Breezy. I just feel like there's a lot of truth to what he told her. I don't think he was just manipulating her. Like, of course he was to some extent. But I think he legitimately identifies with her and feels like he's more like her than he is his children.
He probably wishes that she was his child.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she grew up, in a sense, the way that he did.
Yeah, so that's what he told her.
You know, in the hood and stuff like that. And his children, you know, didn't experience that. Well, Andre did, you know, growing up, but Jamal a little bit, but, you know, they...
I mean, not kinda, really. By the time they were, like, seven, or Andre was, like, seven or eight, I think, like, his father was getting signed.
I think Andre was older. I'd say about a... Well, we don't know how long it took since Cookie went to jail to... Lucius, you know.
It couldn't have taken long, though, because he built, like, an empire. It wasn't like he just had a couple good records. Yeah.
Andre does understand, you know, the life, because he did live, like, you know, him, you know, with the dealing with the cops as a kid, you know, helping his father, you know, with illegal
stuff. Well, he's murdered a man now, so he's got that.
Yeah. Well, technically his wife did. Okay. Oh, what's the scene we forgot? Cookie and...
I kind of saw that coming. I was like, why are we lingering on this shot? There it is.
With the long one on his back. Oh, gosh. It was funny because I didn't forget, but the guy that she, that, you know, her love interest, I forgot that them two played in a movie together as love interest. Yeah, I think it was a Tyler Perry movie. I could do
that all
by myself.
Yeah, everybody's been in a Tyler Perry movie.
Tyler Perry movie. But yeah, they played love interest in that movie. So it explains, you know, they do have good chemistry together, I think.
All right, well, I will be back to Empire next week. Hopefully, I will enjoy it more, and hopefully we progress on these storylines. Next up, The Leftovers. Starving or freezing or so very poor. No one laughs at God when a doctor calls after some routine tests. No one's laughing at God. Alright, The Leftovers fucking fascinated me this week. The reason that I thought the song was fitting is everything on the show could be supernatural, but almost everything has a likely darker, more realistic alternative. Like, maybe Kevin seeing a ghost, he's probably not. Maybe Matt's wife came back to life for a day, but he probably raped her. Like, the dreary, depressing nature of the show makes it more important that the characters believe in something. Because if they don't, they're John. Like, they're running around burning things down so they know they exist. Is this inherently a show about people punishing themselves? Is my first question to you.
I'm not sure, but it's possible. It's possible, you know, these characters are punishing themselves. But I believe you're right, that these characters, you know, they have to believe in something or they end up losing themselves, which I actually think that's the issue with the character John, that he doesn't believe in this place, miracle, and, you know, he doesn't seem like a religious man, so he doesn't really believe in stuff, so he has this tendency to burn stuff down and stuff. Literally, I guess, you know, you literally burn the guy, you know, down.
Yeah, it's not just if you think about people punishing themselves. So this episode was obviously a large take on that. I don't know of anybody who has more of a Job complex than Matt. But the guilty remnant constantly punishes himself. Kevin constantly punishes himself. He's still punishing himself for what happened with Patty. Like, they don't actually get into stockades that say repent and get naked and, like, hung outside some sort of weird, like, festival atmosphere on a border. But they might as well. I mean, why not? If you're gonna, like, be quiet and smoke in the snow all day, you might as well get in the stockades. I don't know.
Yeah.
The early moments of this episode, oh my God. They sort of evoke a loneliness and a stagnation of loneliness that might be the most relatably sad thing The Leftovers has thrown at us. By, like, the third day that Matt woke up and he was doing the same thing with Mary again. Like, I mean, it's tough to watch. Like, I think it's supposed to be. I thought it was fitting that in an episode about a character being willing to suffer, like, we had to suffer with him. I let you know right away, like, this isn't going to be fun.
Yeah.
You didn't tune in to hear the new rap song by Breezy, bitch. You're getting Matt in the stockades.
Yeah, this is probably one of my favorite episodes so far. It was, and I loved it that they focused on this character. And, you know, the way that it was done, and, you know, him still, you know, trying to fight and believe what he does believe, you know, believing that his wife did indeed, you know, wake up.
Did he rape his wife, Ash? I'm putting you on the spot.
I have no idea, but I do love that this show makes you wonder, like, did it happen or didn't, you know, like, and it does it a lot on the show. Like, it makes you wonder, like, you know, what happened? You know, it gives you that question a lot in this show. So this is just another one of those things, you know. Did she really wake up, or did he, you know, his mind fuck with him, and then he ended up raping his own, you know, catatonic wife? And as the show keeps going on, it gets more and more, that feeling gets more and more dread. And I think it gets more and more dread with this character as well. Like, he's still trying to hold on to that belief that his wife did indeed wake up, because he don't want to believe the alternative.
Well, that's valid. I mean, and nothing, no scene could show that more clearly than when the doctor is basically accusing him of rape, and he just has, like, the biggest smile on his face. Like, he is in such denial. It leads me to want to talk about the actual character of Job in the Bible. I never understood the book of Job. I understand it. I never thought that it made... Yeah. Ash, can you hear me? Ash?
Yeah.
I was saying, I never thought the book of Job makes a lot of sense, because God makes a bet with the devil that no matter what Satan does to Job, Job will not turn from God. So Satan takes everything from Job, and he keeps torturing him and torturing him and torturing him, and his wife says, curse God and die, Job, and then his wife dies. And, like, Job will not. But, like, if this is a God that is willing to play with you like this and humiliate you and torture you, why are you so faithful to him? And that's almost the question I have to get with Matt, because it's the second episode that focused on him. We had one last season, and they were structured the same, where they were like these wild rides, and, like, things just kept getting worse for him until you were like, can it actually get worse? Oh, well, just did.
it can.
So, like, why is the person who gets, like, the shittiest end of every stick, like, the most faithful person? It's a really interesting question to me.
I guess he has to believe in something, and this is something that he knows. So, it's hard. I guess it's also hard to break habit, you know, but if he loses faith in God, then he can very much lose himself, and that's something that he does not want to do.
Well, has he not lost himself already? Like, he just left his pregnant, like, paralyzed wife in his sister's care so he could go to be naked in the stockades. that's what he did. What did you think about, like, the settlement outside of Miracle? Because I want a fucking show there.
Oh, God. That would be an awesome spinoff. Like, that amount of chaos and just what the fuck, what was going on there. It shows, I guess, a different side of, you know, a different story of people who, you know, that we haven't really seen yet.
Ever. Not just on The Leftovers. Ever.
Well, the side of people, like, what has happened to these people since, you know, this all went since the departure, you know.
Yeah.
And they found, like, this, what they believe is, like, the safe haven, and... What this has all turned them to.
Yeah. Okay. So, I can't help but get away from... I'm going to talk about the settlement, but I can't get away from the Border Patrol parallel. And, like, we saw, like, the young couple being, like, attacked as they tried to get in. But it's also notable that here, the people who are willing to risk their safety to make it across the border are doing so because they believe in the lie, essentially, that is Miracle. They believe there is something different and special about Jordan, Texas. And I almost feel like that has to be commentary on people who are risking their lives to get into the United States.
Yeah.
They feel that it is somehow special and different, and then they get here and they're working sub-minimum wage, and they don't have, you know, they have no health. Like,
Yeah, I actually thought about the same thing, you know, about the parallel of the two. And I think it probably was done on, you know, on purpose to get that that parallel to, like, things that's happening today and stuff like that, and that specifically.
And I'm going to assume the settlement is on the other border, and that's Canada, because, you know, fucking Canada. Because that's the shit Canadians do. They give you a big wooden stick, and they want you to hit them with it and scream out a dude's name.
Oh, God.
That was one of the more bizarre things ever, ever on my television, and I've watched a lot. Also, like, it just seems like everybody's, like, really living out their fetishes in this little settlement, and I don't really know what that has to do with Miracle. I'm fascinated, but confused.
I don't know. Maybe it's a sense of freedom being at, you know, at this place, or I don't know.
Did you roll your eyes at any point when Mary couldn't find, when the pregnant Mary couldn't find a place to stay? There was no room open.
Yeah, I thought about that too. I, like, it popped in my head. I was like, okay, sure.
Why not?
Yeah.
I thought the confrontation between Matt and John was my favorite scene, and I thought it was really well positioned because it wasn't Matt versus John. It was shown to be like that, but in reality, it was Matt versus himself. It was a test of his conviction. John was saying, "Will you renounce what you have been saying? Because I don't like it, and if you want my help, you're going to say something else." And in the end, Matt would not curse God and die. He intends to make things as difficult as he can for himself, because he believes. And even though he annoys me, and his big goofy face is annoying, I have to admire the character in some way. I'll say this, on a lesser show, Matt is the hero. On a lesser show, Matt is the hero who believes and no one else does. In the Leftovers world, maybe he's a hero, maybe he's a deranged rapist. It's not so clear, and I mean, I admire that about the show, but yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult to always come to terms with. Anything else you want to get to about the Leftovers?
No, I think we covered all the main points. The Swedish?
the Swede. By the way, Matt trusts everybody. He trusts the weird woman who wants him to hit her boy. He trusts the Swede. He trusts the guy on the side of the road who almost kills him. Like, he trusts everybody.
Yeah. Like, look where he's dying now.
Yeah, really. And he has such faith that he leaves the little boy with John, and he goes to the stockades where he's... I assume he has faith that somebody is going to come take his place.
Yeah.
Which they may not.
Might be up there for a while.
Yeah. Did you have a favorite scene?
My favorite scene was the scene with Matt and John, because it was like super intense. Like, I was.
It was.
Really wondering, like, how that was gonna, you know, play out. But
and Kevin, of course, just standing around.
Yeah, like what the hell? He's like, Kevin, this whole episode, he's like, the part that he was in, like, when Matt was saying that he was going back, his sister was going back, he was like, what the hell?
Goddamn, Kevin, like, never does anything. He's not even the one that saves Matt. He's just along for the ride with his wife. Like, Kevin never does anything.
He has no idea what's going on in his life or anyone else's. Just like, what the hell?
All right, so we are about halfway through the Leftovers this season. We will be back next week. Up next is Fargo. Stay with us. So, this week's Fargo was entitled Fear and Trembling. First off, I want to ask you, is Lou right? Was there ever a good imbalance where people knew a good balance where people knew right from wrong?
No, I don't think he is. I think that's just something he wants to believe. Mm-hmm. You know, because people, you know, even in this situation, the world he lives in, do know right from wrong. They just choose whether to actually do it.
So I agree that that's sort of the attitude that populated post-war Vietnam, and it's still something people say now, right? They say, like, well, back when I grew up, you know, the world was a better place. Well, this is set in 1979 that he's saying this.
Yeah.
And we got a scene from 1951 where not just, like, a group of people are murdered in the theater. Like, one of them is gruesomely murdered by a little boy.
Who died.
Did it throw you off at all that we began in 1951?
No. I wasn't sure what was happening at first, like who the characters were until, you know, it said that dad said Dodd's name, then I understood what was happening. It was Dodd, you know.
Like, here's why Dodd's so fucked up.
Yeah. He had to murder a man. His father got him to kill a guy in a movie theater when he was just a little boy.
Yep. And I mean, I still hate Dodd, but he was more enjoyable this episode, especially in the donut shop, where he beat the shit out of some people and then ordered a glazed and an old fashioned. Also, there was that scene early on at the hospital that was like also like gruesomely comic. I mean, just like really black comedy here. He's like, it's not a war on you. It's a war on your body.
Yeah, I was like, worst doctor ever. Who's the doctors on these shows nowadays? They're just terrible.
Well, I mean, that reminds me a lot of the actual political climate, though, like the quote-unquote war on women. Like, it's not a war on you, it's a war on your body, see? It's nothing to do with you. So what was the more engaging post-coital scene? Was it the Plemons Dunt scene, or was it Mike Milligan and Dodd's daughter?
I'll probably have to give it to Mike because, one, I love the twist that, you know, the reveal of who he was sleeping with and how casual it just seemed like.
He was so casual about getting a thumb up the ass, man.
Yeah. Oh my God.
That was unexpected.
Because I didn't say I liked it.
Yeah, he just said it was unexpected. He says it in like the same, sing-songy, I don't give a fuck way. He was like, that's truly an odd question.
It's like, huh. Like, I expect him to say that like at the end. Like, huh. Yeah, like, that's how he views things. It's like, oh man, I love that scene. It was just so, like, these two people who should be enemies, you know, the people they work for are rivals, and here they are sleeping with each other, and this is a sense of betrayal, but it just seems so casual.
Yeah, well, I like the reveal part of it. I also liked how her character is just, like, telling Mike Milligan whatever the fuck he wants. So he didn't even have to ask her. She's just, like, volunteering family secrets. And he's like, okay.
Like, she really does not care.
But, I mean, compared to Dodd, Mike Milligan's a great guy. So, I mean, you know, it's not, maybe she's got some daddy issues probably, but, you know, I mean, she could do worse than Mike.
And she even told Mike, she was like, you know, you probably have to kill him. Like, it was no big deal, like, telling this guy you probably have to kill your father.
I mean, holy fuck, Ash, I don't objectify women, okay? But if I was to do that sort of thing, I might say that Dodd's daughter is fucking hot. I might say that sort of thing.
I agree.
How did you feel about the Plemons Dunt scene, especially like the gender politics at play throughout, like who controls the finances?
It was a very tricky scene because I understood both sides of the situation. Because, you know, I understand, you know, being upset, like, she just took the money and not only, you know, took the money and used it, you know, for herself. He was trying to use the money, you know, for the family as a whole. But there was the problem with it was the lack of communication with these two.
Yeah. there is.
But I also understood, you know, her wanting to do something for herself and better herself, especially since her husband doesn't seem too fond of it. But, you know, she's in a time where, you know, this woman, you know, this other, her boss is, you know, trying to empower her to be better because she deserves it.
Is she, like, I have some really complicated feelings about the agenda that her lesbian boss is pushing. Because, like, in theory, I agree with her. Like, right? She should be able to do what she wants to do. But in practice, like, her boss is actually manipulating her as well. Like, she's telling her what to do. And that's not letting her do what she wants to do. That's telling her what to do. like, if she wants to be a housewife, she should be able to. And, I don't know. I agree with you about the miscommunication 100%. Like, I kind of think greed and miscommunication is the source of almost, like, all problems people have with each other. And I think, like, this series and this episode showcase that a lot. Like, almost all the problems are caused by either, like, somebody wants more money, wants more power, or, you know, people can't communicate properly.
Yeah.
I thought Plemons was, like, really subtle, using his power as the chief wage earner to, like, enforce his will, or try to. And it almost, like, negates the sympathy we would give him for having an awful wife, because she is awful. and I would side with her if she was spending this money on college or something. She's spending it on, like, some kind of bullshit self-help seminar, just so we're clear. Like, this isn't going to actually help her.
It's not going to get you a better job. It's like a self-esteem.
And so she sacrifices, like, their chance to, like, earn her, you know, for his chance and their chance as a family to, like, have a stable business for her, like, you know, like, whimsical desire to go on a retreat. I mean, that's not, that's just not good decision making. I don't really know what else to say.
Well, let's be honest. She don't want a family. She don't want the kids and the dog.
No, she doesn't.
Like, she's taking birth control pills. You can see the look on her face when he was talking about it, you know, stuff like, before she even popped the pills, about, you know, the kids and bigger house. She doesn't want any of that.
No, but she is definitely willing to get down if she thinks he's about to discover a dead man in the garage. But you're right. That's not what she wants. But what does she... I don't think she knows what she wants. She just knows that, like... I think, hopefully, she knows at this point, because I feel like this episode was a turning point. Hopefully, she knows she's in way over her head. I thought, like, the scene where Lou Silverson gives Peggy and the husband, like, one last chance to save themselves.
Yeah.
I really feel like that's a turning point for us, because it's like, we could go in two directions here. Which way do you guys want to go? And they chose the only way this could go, which is, like, now the Gerhardts are going to come meet up with them, and, like, Kansas City and the Gerhardts are going to war. I almost feel like this is all going to start to come to a head in the next couple of episodes. And last season, we got a flash forward for the last few episodes. Like, we went ahead a couple of years. That may happen again, just because, like, I don't know how much longer these storylines play out before people start killing each other. It's so close. They're so close to murdering each other.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. So I wouldn't be surprised if it does do a flash forward to show, like, because time, when you think about it on the show at this point, it's kind of moving. It's moving quite slow.
Time is a flat circle.
it's moving very slow. We're into the fourth episode, and we're only a few days after you know the proposition.
Yeah.
City first turned up.
Yeah.
So I don't think everybody's gonna.
I mean, this is so thick, and I mean that in a good way. It's so literary, like dense in a literary way. So much rich context to every scene that happens, like, that I'm okay with the slower pace. Like, we talked earlier with Julissa about, American Horror Story, and how Ryan Murphy gets a lot of creative control, and sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes it's not. I think Noah Hawley does a great job with his creative control, because, like, they're everything, in, even though these episodes sometimes go, like, 10 minutes too long, or 10 minutes over, like, a normal episode, like, it never feels like they waste the scene. Like, every scene is tightly connected to everything. By the way, Nick Offerman's goatee deserves everything. And his attitude about the angry Native American was awesome, too. We have a problem, friend.
Oh, man. The way you say friend was so funny. I don't know why that made me laugh so hard. It was like, oh, shit.
Okay. One other scene I feel like we should probably mention. Brad Garrett scene, the Kansas City guy scene with Floyd. Thought they did a really good job of conveying the strength of both characters. And Brad Garrett is a huge man. And, like, being positioned next to Floyd, being positioned next to, a smaller woman, you can really, he uses his size to convey menace really well. Like, he doesn't have to say anything. Just stand up, and it's like, oh, shit. Like, that's a giant man. He might hurt her.
He's a large guy. Yeah.
Yep.
Wasn't intimidated, by him.
She wasn't, but maybe she should. I don't think the Gerhardts are going to win this war.
Yeah. Dodd is the one that's fucking it. I mean, they was probably going to, but they had a better chance before.
Oh, yeah, Dodd's a fuck-up. He is. There's no doubt about that. And he also spawned a daughter who he made hate him so much she sleeps with his enemies and tells all the secrets. So that's even worse.
Guy, a grandfather killed because.
As much as you can kill a man who looks like he's already a vegetable.
Yeah.
My favorite scene was Lou going to Peggy and Jesse Plemons' house to give them that last chance. I thought it was a really well done scene. And I also think Lou's probably way too smart to be like a highway cop. That's just my thing.
He's a smart guy. A bit quite naive, but smart.
Do you have a favorite scene?
I'll have to say the sit down. Okay. I love the way the sit down played out because it showed they gave not just more depth with the Gerhardts with like Floyd, but also it tied in with her husband and. Also, Dodd, about, who they are. You see, Dodd is trying so hard to emulate his father, the brutality of, the way they do things. And here's Floyd trying to do, be reasonable, but she's also she's very calculated and smart. She's clearly the smart one of the operation. She's the brains behind the operation, and which is a contrast to her husband. Like, when the dude was like, I wish I had met your husband. He's like, no, you don't. Because he would have shot you when you first brought this, proposition in the first place. So you should be glad that you're meeting with his wife.
Yeah, that's what she said. I'm still of the mindset that Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers are going to have the last laugh here. that awesome prog rock band.
I'm really interested with, and I love the scene when she was like, she was grieving, over her husband, the fear that she possibly lost him, what happened, and the deal falling through, and, her husband, and then she just comes out, we're going to war.
Yeah.
She's ready.
I'm going to lead into the soapbox by asking this question. Fargo is the most highly, highly recorded, highly praised show on television from a critical standpoint. It has the highest reviews on Metacritic of any show in 2015, and only a few shows in history, a few seasons of television in history, have the sort of critical acclaim that season 2 of Fargo has. So, is Fargo the best show you have watched in 2015? And if not, what is?
Well, I guess considering that I haven't, didn't watch the first season.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, this is probably is the... we're only in the fourth
episode. Yeah, we're only about halfway through.
Yeah, but I'd say so far, the way it's structurally done, the way the acting, superb, I have to say it probably is the top show for me right now.
I think it's the top show right now. I'm going to go back to something I said a few months ago, which is that as much as I love a show like Fargo, and I love like the last season of Mad Men, like, that, what Mr. Robot was doing was something completely different to television than we've ever seen, and I have to give that audacity a lot of points. But I do love Fargo a lot. Do you have anything specifically you want to talk about this week? Is The Walking Dead over? I'm unclear.
No, Walking Dead is over.
It feels like it should be over by now. Jesus.
That's Nope. In fact, it just got renewed for another season.
I don't mean like over. I just mean like over for the season.
No, we're approaching the mid-season finale, I think, in a couple episodes. But, this episode was pretty much a flashback episode. It was a flashback bottle episode. And I know a lot of Walking Dead fans are not too pleased, you know, with these, with bottle episodes focusing just on one character, especially since we have, like, it's a big ensemble cast. So, but I personally enjoyed it. But I know a lot of people wasn't, you know, too thrilled because what happened, you know, last week, you know, with the cliffhangers, you know, of Glenn's fate and stuff like that, and Rick's fate, and, you know, everything that's going on with the giant horde coming towards Alexandria. But I felt it was a, to me, I felt it was a great break, you know, from all that tension, you know, because, you know, and focus on this character who has been a fan favorite, and fans have been wanting the backstory of how he got from a man who was completely out of his mind to this very serene and very, not necessarily passive, this badass ninja-like character, and he's very, I guess, stable, and he doesn't like killing, you know, killing anymore, and it showed the backstory of how he transformed and how this man who he met, you know, was able to transform him into the person that he is today. And granted, it was an hour and a half long, and it was long. And some people, like, they could have just did that in 10 minutes. But I enjoyed, you know, the goat. There was a goat in this episode, by the way. but I loved the story of it. You know, it for me personally, it let my mind focus on something else instead of just the fate. And it's going to pick back up, you know, next episode, so it was a good break.
Well, I mean, it wasn't the best goat on TV this week. I know that. It wasn't a companion, a human companion helper.
The goat was a major cat.
The goat wasn't having sex with Chad. All right, if it didn't have sex with Chad, it's not the best goat. Chad only fucks the best goats, Ash.
okay.
How are you going to dispute this? Chad has excellent tasting goats.
Okay.
What? Why? What? You don't like Chad's goat? Is it not a good goat?
I love Chad's goat. I love Chad's goat. I just think the character Morgan had the goat had a lot more character.
That's what I want to. That's what I tuned in the TV for, to see the depth of the character in the goats. You're the Worst has been really good. And I just want to say, like, I don't know if Aya Cash is going to get nominated for an Emmy this year or not. She really, really deserves it. Like, she's playing throughout a comedy series, a dark comedy series, but a comedy series, like, a character with clinical depression. And she's, like, doing that balance between, like, manic and depressive and just wearing it so well. She's doing such a great job. And again, like, one for the 10th time in our 7 episodes, I really encourage everybody to watch that show. I can't speak highly enough of it, but the reason we don't talk about it on here is because nobody watches it, including Ash. So anyway, that's our show. Thank you for listening. Please like, comment, share, subscribe, and comment. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. Let us know, you know, if everybody who listened told us what they were listening for, I promise we could have a show that catered to our audience's, you know, likes and dislikes better. But largely, we don't. We don't know. We know that people are listening. We don't know why. We hope it's because we're just that good and entertaining. But, you know, if that's not it, let us know. And if it is it, let us know. I could use the help with my ego. All right, guys. check us out with Your Childhood Trauma, our weekly Buffy pod. I'm John.
And I'm Ash.
And thanks for listening. We're out.